Okay, so we're going to first start looking for Babylon in Isaiah's prophecy. So we're going to read, I don't know if you got a chance to read through this at home, but we will read beginning in chapter 13. So Isaiah here is prophesying over 100 years before the actual fall of Babylon. Chapter 13. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. On a bare hill, raise a signal. Cry aloud to them. Wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. I myself have commanded my consecrated ones, and have summoned my mighty men to execute my anger, my proudly exulting ones. The sound of a tumult is on the mountains, as of a great multitude, the sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. The Lord of hosts is mustering a host for battle. They come from a distant land, from the end of the heavens, the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come. Therefore, all hands will be feeble, and every human heart will melt. They will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. I'll make people more rare than fine gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I'll make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken out of its place, at the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And like a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own people, and each will flee to his own land. Whoever is found will be trust true, and whoever is caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. Behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them, who have no regard for silver and do not delight in gold. Their bows will slaughter the young men. They will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor and pomp of the Chaldeans, will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherds will make their flocks lie down there. But wild animals will lie down there, and their houses will be full of howling creatures. Their ostriches will dwell, and their wild goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in their towers, and jackals in their pleasant palaces. Its time is close at hand, and its days will not be prolonged. And we'll keep going in chapter 14. For the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and will again choose Israel and will set down in their own land, and sojourners will join them and will attach themselves to the house of Jacob. And the people will take them and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them in the Lord's land as male and female slaves. They will take captive those who are their captors and rule over those who oppress them. When the Lord has given you rest from your pain and turmoil and the hard service with which you were made to serve, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has ceased, the insolent fury ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, that struck the people in wrath with unceasing blows, that ruled the nations in anger with unrelenting persecution. The whole earth is at rest and quiet. They break forth into singing. The cypresses rejoice at you, the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you are laid low, no woodcutter comes up against us. Sheol beneath is stirred up to meet you when you come. It rouses the shades to greet you. All who are leaders of the earth, it raises from their thrones. All who are kings of the nations. All of them will answer and say to you, you too have become as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, the sound of your harps. Maggots are laid as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covers. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, above the stars of God. I'll set my throne on high. I'll sit on the assembly of on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north. I'll ascend above the heights of the clouds. I'll make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, who did not let his prisoners go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. But you are cast out, away from your grave, like a loathed branch, clothed with the slain, those pierced by the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit, like a dead body trampled underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land, you have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers nevermore be named. Prepare slaughter for his sons, because of the guilt of their fathers, lest they raise and possess the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off Babylon, name and remnant, descendants and posterity, declares the Lord. And I will make it a possession of the hedgehog and pools of water. I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. All right, so that was quite long. So like I said, Isaiah is prophesying here over 100 years before the actual fall of Babylon. So at this time when he's prophesying, Babylon's not even a big empire. Yes. So it's not even a big empire. The big empire at this time was Assyria. So if you take a quick look at the history of Babylon, which we kind of see alluded here, especially in chapter 14, when it's talking about how in 14, verse 13, like, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I'll set my throne on high. I'll sit on the assembly, mount of assembly. Does that bring into mind anything that we know from the Bible? Well, here it's more talking about Babylon, kind of what the people in Babylon are saying.
You're talking about Nebuchadnezzar's attitude of himself.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
His own self-assessment was, I'm the boss, everybody else is going to bow down because of the world domination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely the attitude of Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. But also, so for the immediate audience who are listening to Isaiah prophesying, this would probably remind them of kind of the very first time this attitude we see in the Bible, which is the Tower of Babel, back in Genesis. I guess that's Genesis 10 or no 11. So real quick, we can go through kind of the history of Babylon up to this point. So the first time we see Babylon mentioned in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 10. We can turn there to verse 8. Genesis 10:8. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And from that land, he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Kala, and Resen between Nineveh and Kala, that is the great city. So that's the first mention of Babel, which I guess initially they called it as like the city with the gate to God. But then, in Genesis chapter 11, I'm assuming we're familiar with the story of the Tower of Babel, where people all got together, they had one language, so they decided that, let's kind of build this monument for ourselves because, we're kind of bigger than God. We can reach to the heavens all by ourselves. And so, and that's where God had to come down and confuse their languages. So from that point, kind of the name of Babel was changed to just mean confusion. So today, I guess, we can kind of trace our English word Babel to like babbling to the Tower of Babel. So that is kind of the initial reference to Babylon. And then from that point, kind of a few centuries down the line, we see the first kind of historical kingdom of Babylon. And if you're familiar with Babylonian history, you might have heard of this guy Hammurabi, who was supposed to be kind of the first king who kind of codified a law. So we have, I think we still have remnants of his law over probably at like the Louvre, where he was the first one who codified kind of the law for his entire nation. And they have it in like a stone tablet. And they say there's a lot of similarities between kind of the Babylonian kingdom and kind of some of the surrounding kingdoms, including some of what we see in the Mosaic Law. So that initial Babylonian kingdom was it was strong and powerful, and it was probably the biggest kingdom at that point. And then they fell. They actually fell to the Assyrians, who were kind of nearby, which we saw in Genesis 10, another city that Nimrod built of Nineveh. So the Assyrians came and they took over Babylon, and then eventually they kind of gave them independent rule. And then the Babylonian kingdom, so that's kind of around the time when Isaiah is writing, where Assyrians are the kingdom in power, and Babylon's kind of this kind of old kingdom that it's been kind of out of the picture of world history. But then, you know, the future where, you know, Babylon comes rises up again, and, you know, they reach new heights under Nebuchadnezzar. So that's kind of the history of Babylon up until this point. So, all right, so our first question here. So let's assume that Isaiah did not kind of specify Babylon or Medes or Chaldeans. Are there things that we see in this prophecy in chapters 13 and 14 that kind of, based on what we learned in Daniel so far in chapters 1 to 5, do we see any kind of correlation of how this would apply there? Well, Seth touched on it a little. The whole kind of ascent to heaven, that was kind of the attitude that we saw in both Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. And another thing that I saw was like in chapter 13, verse 11, kind of the second half where it says, I'll put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. That was another thing that is, you know, that totally fits the attitudes of Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. And also in chapter 14, verse 17, I guess kind of the second half of 16, is this a man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert, and overthrew his cities, who did not let his prisoners go home, which we see, you know, with the exile of the Hebrews, where, you know, they go and they raid the nation, and they take their best people, and they kind of let the you know, they tear down the temple and basically ruin Jerusalem. And it wasn't just Jerusalem that they did that. They did that to pretty much every other kingdom that they conquered. That was kind of their philosophy behind their empire building, is they just go and tear down their other neighboring kingdoms. And another thing in terms of history is, so Isaiah specifically calls out that God's going to stir up the Medes against them. So at this time, the Medes were kind of very insignificant. They're probably more like a barbarian tribe, and they had really no political power at this time. But what we know from history is that when the Persians, who eventually conquered Babylon, The first kingdom that they conquered when the Persians started coming to power was the Medes. They were kind of like neighbors. And they attacked them and they took over them in like weeks. But they didn't destroy them. They essentially kind of co-opted them to become like the Persian Mede Empire. So when Isaiah is writing this prophecy, like the Medes were these people that, you know, just like how Babylon was this empire that's kind of on the down. The Medes are insignificant people, but you know, he is predicting exactly what's going to happen later on in Daniel. All right. So the next question is, so if you flip a few pages, we don't have to read any of these, but if you just look at the kind of the subtitles in there, it's basically Isaiah chapters 13 to 24. It's kind of God's judgment to all the nations around Israel. So we kind of see a little section on Assyria, then Philistia, Moab, Damascus, and even Jerusalem's in here, and Egypt, and on. So it's basically God has a message for each of these nations at this time. So I have a typo there, but what I want to ask is, why is he starting with Babylon, and why is Babylon given the most space? So some of these countries, they only get like a paragraph or maybe a chapter, but Babylon definitely is, you know, first and foremost, and it gets a lot of real estate. So any kind of speculation on why that might be? That could be one of the reasons. So what she's referring to is Nebuchadnezzar's dream, right, where he has a statue where Babylon is the head with the gold, and then further kingdoms are coming. But also remember, like, Isaiah's writing this, 100 years before what we see going on in Daniel. So, like, Babylon's kind of on their, a low point. But people, like, you know, in the audience, they probably still remember how, you know, Babylon used to be this big empire. And also, you know, also kind of what happened in the beginning with the Tower of Babel. And kind of that was the beginning of kind of, one of the big things of human rebellion against God. Yeah, we'll definitely touch on that a little bit. Like Seth said, if you look at the history of Babylon, Abraham and Sarah are from their area. So I think their city was called Ur. And that was before kind of the official Babylon Empire. But this was just, you know, big city in kind of what was called like Mesopotamia. So that's where Abraham and Sarah, they're called out of there, and God calls them to the promised land. So it kind of... I guess I'm kind of getting ahead, but if you see kind of the whole like Babylon versus Jerusalem, you have like Abraham and Sarah called out, from essentially the land that's eventually called Babylon. They're called out of there to go to the promised land. And then when Israel's unfaithful, God kind of sends them back to Babylon. So the northern kingdom, they go to, they're captured by the Assyrians, which is just, you know, like miles north of what's Babylon. And then when the southern kingdom, when it's time for their punishment, they are they go to Babylon, and then God raises up King Cyrus, who would eventually, you know, after their captivity is done, he's going to send them back to Jerusalem. So it's kind of, you see this back and forth. They go from Babylon to Jerusalem. And if you look at it in modern day, so Assyria, which the capital city of Nineveh, that's in, so it's in Iraq, it's modern day like Mosul. And Babylon is essentially like 50 miles from Baghdad. So I think like Saddam Hussein had like a summer palace near Baghdad. So like if you've lived through the Gulf Wars, you'll be kind of familiar with at least those modern day names. So the next question is, so the audience here is Israel. Like Isaiah is prophesying to Israel, and this prophecy was not sent to the nations that he was prophesying to, like a warning. So this is not like God sending Jonah to Nineveh to warn them against punishment. So you know, this was most likely just for Israel. Like the other nations never got to hear this prophecy. So what is the purpose of this prophecy then? You mean the period of the exile? That was like 60 to 70 years before kind of people started coming back. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So Nick says, like, God's telling them to stay faithful, that even if this, you know, this kingdom is coming to take over, like, you know, they will eventually fall. Which we've been talking about, that, you know, as we're reading through Daniel, that, you know, God's saying that, like, no matter what happens to all these other nations and what they're doing to Israel, God is still in control, and, you know, he's in charge of the final destiny. Yeah, so that's really good. We're going to head there in a bit. And all right, so I had one last question before we move on. So some of the specifics of this judgment seem rather harsh, especially like I said, like chapter 13, verse 16, where it says, their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes, their houses will be plundered, and their wives ravished. So what we know from, you know, Daniel chapters 1 to 5, like, did Babylon even deserve this?
Two things come to mind. I would say, number one, you know, well, like Jesus said in the gospel, he says, that the evil must come, but woe to the one by whom through mm-hmm. whom it comes. We're talking about Judas. Mm-hmm. But not only is this an idolatrous land in general, you know, very similar to Sodom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that idolatrous nation is a tool that's being used to enact
Yeah. And especially when we see in like chapter 14 where it's like Israel is taunting Babylon, they're not just kind of like rejoicing over some like, you know, one fallen king. It's more like symbolic of like, you know, eventually we having victory over evil. And so some of the specifics in here is it says how like Babylon's going to fall in one day and it'll never be inhabited again. But what we know from history is that, you know, like we read in Daniel 5, like they came up and took over in one night, but they didn't really destroy that city. The Persians, at least their kind of their philosophy of rule is they kind of co-opt the kingdom. They let a local ruler in charge. They don't necessarily like raise cities down. And well, one of the things we know is that Alexander the Great actually died in Nebuchadnezzar's palace a few hundred years after kind of what happened in Daniel chapter 5. So, you know, the Persians left that thing in place. And after the Persians, you know, came the Greeks. And Alexander the Great, you know, he happened to die in Babylon. So what happened with the Persians is just kind of the beginning of the end. And I guess today we can say that, you know, it's this empty desert there. There's just ruins of Babylon. It's not a city anymore. But some of the specifics in here is kind of, you know, it's something that's more cosmic. It's larger than life. And it's pointing to like a greater reality where, you know, the system of the world, where the empires of the world that stand in opposition to God, they will eventually fail. And so, which brings us to Revelation. So we have Isaiah prophesying, and then we also have Jeremiah prophesying kind of a little after this about Babylon and its coming fall. And then it actually, we see that happening in Daniel. But the Bible keeps talking about Babylon, and we see a lot of that in Revelation. And I specified Revelation 18, but there's actually two chapters just on Babylon's kind of punishment. So both chapter 17 and 18 talk about Babylon. So 17 is more of like their religious judgment against Babylon. It talks about how you have Babylon and there's the beast, and he's using Babylon the prostitute, and he's riding her, and then he gets tired of her, and the beast and the kings of the earth destroy her. So I don't have time to go into all of that and what that means, so we'll stick with just chapter 18. So let me read that real quick. All right, so Revelation 18. After this I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she herself had paid back others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she makes. As she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning, since in her heart she says, 'I sit as a queen, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see.' For this reason her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine, and she'll be burned up with fire. For mighty is the Lord God who has judged her. And the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, 'Alas, alas, you great city, you are mighty, you mighty city Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come.' And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, and sheep, horses and chariots and slaves, that is, human souls. The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your delicacies and your splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gain wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels and with pearls. For in a single hour all this wealth has been laid waste. And all shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors and all whose trade is on the sea, stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? And they drew dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, alas, alas, for the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth, for in a single hour she had been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and ye saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, so will Babylon the great city be thrown down with violence and will be found no more. And the sound of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpeters will be heard in you no more. And a craftsman of any craft will be found in you no more. And the sound of the mill will be found in you no more. And the light of a lamp will shine in you no more. And the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more. And your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her were found the blood of prophets and of saints, and of all who have been slain on earth. All right. So I guess, so what are we seeing as some of the reasons why Babylon's being punished in chapter 18? And do we see similarities between this and kind of Isaiah's prophecy and how that played out in Daniel with Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar? Yeah, so they see, it talks about how there's this city that's prosperous and powerful, but it's also idolatrous and dangerous. And, you know, they're kind of the lead of this kind of big political and economic system of the world. And they're not just looking out for themselves, but they're also kind of controlling the destinies and the minds of, you know, the people around them. So who or what is Babylon today? So a couple of things, I guess, kind of for the original audience that John is writing to. So we see here Babylon has been talked of. It mentions seven hills. And so, you know, and so at this time, kind of so similar to Babylon during Daniel's time, Rome is a big empire at this time. And so the most likely, you know, the original audience will immediately, what comes to mind is the Roman Empire. Because so it's kind of how Nebuchadnezzar took the Hebrews into exile. You know, the Romans are persecuting the Christians. And John, you know, it most likely wrote Revelation after the destruction of the temple. So we see just like how Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple, the Romans have destroyed the temple. And we also see in 1 Peter 5:13, where Peter, we don't have to turn there now, but basically Peter kind of uses Babylon as a metaphor for Rome. He's talking about the church. I think he says like the church in Babylon, where it essentially means the church in Rome. So if you think of Babylon kind of this metaphor, who or what is Babylon today? And there's similar judgment like this kind of throughout the Bible. So like we saw the sections in Isaiah where, you know, God's judging different nations, and especially Isaiah 23, God's talking about judging the nation of Tyre, which was just like what we described here. It was a big trading nation, and God has specific, there were lots of similarities to chapter 18 where he's specifically judging the nation of trade and how people are dependent on them for their economic systems. Anyone have any ideas on who or what could be Babylon today? Or in the future? What was that? I can hear you. Nation or city or?
Las Vegas.
Okay. Yeah, we can make a case for, you know, any of the big cities in the world to be like Babylon, or, you know, just in general, like, you know, if you're alive in the world today, you're probably living in a Babylon kind of setup. So kind of this symbolic idea of Babylon is kind of the best that people can do without God. The symbol of like mankind's rebellion against God. So we saw this, you know, from the beginning where they tried to build a tower to reach heaven, and they're building these great cities. So if you look back to the ancient Babylon, kind of under Nebuchadnezzar, it probably was when they built like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which was supposed to be one of the ancient wonders, and Rome had all these, architectural marvels, which are, you know, still around today. And so it's just a symbol of kind of wealth, trade, prosperity, and also like pleasure, idolatry, excess, exploitation. And you could apply to any of the major cities since Rome and any world city now. I was really stuck at just how much time chapter 18 spends on just luxuries and wealth and trade. And, you know, like how, like today we get our food from like every part of the world. Because if you go to the grocery store, the kind of the vegetables and fruits that we get, you know, they're available like every season, which, you know, if you have a garden, that's not really true. That's not how fruits and vegetables work. But, you know, because we eat them, then, you know, we get all this food from all these other countries. And also, you know, I've heard that there are a lot of countries where their best exports, the people who are living there have never really tasted them, or, you know, they weren't really had the opportunities to wear their best clothes because the West pays more money for that. So they're better off exporting to the West than actually letting their own people enjoy it. And, you know, like we get our electronics from China, and we get stuff assembled from Mexico. And if you need something, when you call on the phone, it's probably like India. And so the kind of essentially the whole world works so that we can live in luxury, right? And of course, there's the description of sexual immorality. And also, you know, if you read about Babylon and other places, it talks about how they sacrifice babies to their gods. And, you know, we sacrifice the unborn, or, you know, like elderly and people with disabilities. They're kind of just in the way of us because we like to worship convenience, and they're just kind of just in the way. So we essentially like sacrifice them. And so there's one commandment in the middle of chapter 18 that stuck out. It's verse 4. It says, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part of her sins, lest you share in her plagues." So there's kind of these two parts where we're not supposed to partake in her sins. And then so that, you know, we don't, we'll be spared of the terrible, the plagues of judgment. So kind of, if we skip ahead a couple of chapters, in Revelation 21, verse 2, it says, "And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." So going back to how we talked about Abraham coming out of Canaan, and we have Jerusalem. So throughout the Bible, we kind of have these two cities, you know, Babylon and Jerusalem. And in Revelation, we talked about how Babylon's being described as the prostitute in 17 and 18. And then it's contrasted that with Jerusalem, which is described as the bride. And so we see that, I guess, kind of throughout the Bible where, you know, Abraham's taken out of Canaan. And if you remember, he meets the, he gets a blessing from King Melchizedek, who is the king of Salem, which is the, kind of the first time we hear the word, that's Jerusalem. That's the first time Jerusalem is described in the Bible. And then after the Israelites come back from their exodus in Egypt, in Joshua 10, they destroy, they defeat the kind of the current king of Jerusalem, and they take over Jerusalem. And then eventually David makes Jerusalem the capital city, and it's the capital city until captivity. And then in captivity, you know, they go back to Babylon, and then when they come back, they rebuild the city and the temple, and it's again the center of the Judaic worship during Jesus' time until, I guess, we get to the, like, Revelation, where by that time the Romans have destroyed the temple. So there's this contrast in the Bible between Babylon and Jerusalem. Like, Babylon's kind of representing the earthly city, and Jerusalem the heavenly city. And one is the big political and economic power. And Jerusalem, which just from history books, they say how it was kind of out of the way from all the major trade routes, and it was never a world empire. So even when Solomon was, you know, he was rich and powerful, it was still a, you know, tiny fraction of a kingdom compared to all the big powers in the world. And then, yeah, we see Babylon the prostitute versus Jerusalem the bride, and how, you know, Babylon is the idolatrous, human-centered kingdom, where Jerusalem is the kingdom that's kind of looking forward to the things that are to come. And I guess if you've read, like, the Pilgrim's Progress, you can think of it as, like, in terms of the city of destruction versus the celestial city. And so I guess kind of I want to make sure we have time for application. So how do we look at the world? You know, where do you feel at home in our kind of our consumer society of Babylon? So we see in Daniel how Daniel and his friends, they move from kind of this, you know, Judah at the time was kind of failing and unstable, and they move to this more powerful kingdom. And even though their religious beliefs and their identities were under attack, they got, like, pretty influential jobs. But they did not compromise their beliefs. They could have compromised their beliefs. They could have followed the status quo, and, you know, they could have enjoyed a pretty wonderful life. But, you know, we see them, they don't live what the king wants them to live. And, you know, their lives are threatened for that. And on top of not just, you know, not just kind of following the written law, they're also kind of resisting the king wherever they could, like we see in, you know, for Daniel chapter 1. So, kind of, how does that apply to us? Like, do we feel at home in kind of the in Babylon, or are we kind of looking towards the future Jerusalem? So one of the things I was thinking of, especially with Revelation 18 being all about economics and wealth and luxuries, is that, like, you know, what do we do? Like, do we just move to, like, a, you know, like, less wealthy place, go live up in a mountain somewhere, or, you know, go to, like, a remote African village or something? And what hit me is that, like, Mike and Rick are right now They're in Uganda in a place called Bundibugyo, which is translated as the place beyond which there's no other. It's essentially supposed to be like the end of the world. But so what we do know about there is even there, they do have computers, they have electricity, and our mission team, we have Skyped with them. So, you know, even when you get as far there as possible, you can't really hide from, you know, technology and, you know, I mean, power of the world. So, any thoughts on this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, definitely. So there's like, you know, two ways to respond against this, right? When you see that warning in 18 where it says like, you know, come out of her, my people, you can take that literally and, you know, definitely be like, you know, outside of culture where you don't engage with culture in anything. We kind of, you know, do our own thing. We don't even, you know, have conversations with people who are not believers. You can go to that extreme, or you can go to the other extreme where, you know, essentially you are part of Babylon and you believe what you're supposed to believe and you do what you're supposed to do. And kind of how do we live in the tension between those two extremes? And I guess that's kind of where it comes back to Daniel, where we see in Daniel how Daniel and his friends, they are kind of giving us this example of kind of how to live in Babylon and how we can adopt a different set of values, can have a different set of priorities. You know, we have different objects that we worship. I guess our object of worship is different than the people around us. And I guess it also took me back to Colossians, where we set our mind on heavenly things and, you know, we focus on, you know, heavenly things. It's essentially, you know, the Jerusalem that's coming. You know, that's where we focus on, not, you know, the Babylon that's on earth. So some of us might have kind of the influence and opportunity to actually do something about some of this injustice that we see described in 18. And some of us, you know, we might voluntarily give up some of our luxuries and opportunities just to maintain a clean conscience. And then, you know, eventually we might even lose things and suffer because we take a stand in what we believe in. But, I guess that's essentially kind of how we live in the tension between this kind of Babylon and Jerusalem. And I guess one thing that really stuck out, kind of thinking back to Daniel, is that how they weren't hating on Babylon. They served the king to the best of their abilities. You know, they were helping the king even when they knew judgment was coming. You know, Daniel was doing his best to explain to the king what was going on. He had compassion on the king, and that should really be our attitude. Okay, so any other thoughts from anyone else on what we talked about today? Ryan, did you have something? Oh, you're stretching. Okay. All right, so next week we'll be back in Daniel. I guess it's chapter 6, week 7. And, all right, so Seth, can you close this?